You are listening to www.interpolink.org.
Penn Sleep Productions.
Yes, Ken Wilper calling for Michael.
Okay, one second, Ken.
Yo.
Hey, buddy, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
Good. What are you doing having a week with some time off?
Well, it's just, you know, one of those things. Between projects, I float a little bit.
Yeah. Have you started writing something already?
No.
Oh, man, isn't that a wonderful period?
It is. But it's a little, I don't know, it's nice and it's also a little anxiety provoking.
You say it without that, something actually a life?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
We both put ourselves in, we don't want the state of fear out there. We create it in our own minds and
That's right.
We write novels. There's so many things I want to talk to you about. Well, let's do two things in particular. I wanted to go over the talk you gave to the National Press Club. Because it actually, the issue you raised there leads into the book I'm writing on Many Faces of Terrorism, because I actually use the loophole that you raise, which is the really impossibility of predicting the future. And yet everybody seems to think it's sort of like if you let go of a shoe, it will drop.
Yes.
Which we know isn't true. Then I use that to sort of drive anything I want to through that hole, that gaping hole of unpredictability. And so I drive a whole series of unbelievable things through. But let's do first things first, you want? And just talk a little bit about that and about state of fear and what's going on with that?
Sure.
It did get you invited to the White House, you know.
It did.
I know.
Yeah, which was pretty interesting.
Pretty interesting.
Never met a president before.
So. No. Well, and what got you there is one of the things that I wanted to talk about, because there is the strangest thing that when you politicize something, and environmental studies, ecology, environmentalism has become one of the most politicized areas that ought to be science, at least there ought to be part of it left that is still science, and even the science part that's left has been politicized
yeah.
to an extraordinary degree.
Right.
And so it's one of the very, very strange sort of like double negatives get you a positive. In other words, there was simply no way that you were saying that you were taking a Republican stance or that you were favoring that. You were saying that, in a sense, you were against two things. You were against bad science and bad politics, that is, mixing them in unwarranted ways.
Yeah.
And so the fact that you would simply disagree with the exaggerated, politicized nature that is sometimes associated with liberal politicians was taken to be that you're basically coming out with a conservative tract. Get you invited to the White House.
Yeah, you know, this is the internet world, so I'm being forwarded emails from inside environmental organizations talking about how they're going to handle the book.
Yeah.
And they clearly decided to present it as Republican propaganda.
Yeah.
And that was the sort of media line from the beginning, and I think it's the easiest way to dispose of it.
So they wanted to basically not approach the science in the book and deal with it scientifically.
No, the nobody wants to talk about that.
Yeah, oh well. But that's what's so sad, in a sense. Yeah, we can come back to that, but you were getting, in the internet age, some of these things forwarded, and so it was pretty clear to you that the way they were going to handle the book was what could be called a smear campaign. It was...
Yeah. I mean, it's anything but address the issue.
Yeah.
In other words, the issue in that sense is, you know, I'm an outside person. I don't have an axe to grind. I'm just looking at this, and I'm concluding that, to me as an outside person, the evidence is surprisingly unpersuasive. That's
yep.
all I'm saying.
Yep.
And, you know, in another world, somebody says, no, let me show you. Let me take
right.
you through it. Let me correct what you don't understand.
Right.
And in the world that we're in, they say, no, you're just a lying member of the opposite party and a paid flack of the oil industry, which is my favorite thing. I never thought anybody would imagine that I'm paid by the oil industry. But they just, you know, and people just claim it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's where we are.
Well, it really hinges in large part on computer scenarios and future predictions and so on. And
absolutely.
What, you know, what's so funny about those is every time you look at future projections from today, then it seems that you have to agree with them if it's politicized or psychologized or if it touches some vein other than science. Because the science would simply say, I don't know, there's a 400% variability, as you pointed out,
yeah,
in even the extreme best of the environmental predictions. But for you not to take, well, close to the party line is perceived as really almost evil, as being really wicked in the deepest sense. But if you go back, the only time you get a sense of history about this, a sense of what's happening, is if you review past projections.
Yes.
And then it's
which
just
no one wants to do.
Nobody wants to do that. Now, we're not saying this means we disagree with you. We're just saying, wait a minute, let's just take a breath and look at this. I did the same thing in quantum questions. We got this whole physics proves mysticism, Tao of physics craze that started in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like some new quantum mechanics was proving mysticism for the first time, and wasn't it extraordinary? And so I went back and did a history review all the way back to Plato. And found, you know, advocates saying, oh, the new physics completely proves spirit and so on. I mean, it's a very, very old argument.
Uh-huh.
But the identical data was used by the other half of the community to prove the spirit doesn't exist. And so you get into this for other reasons than science. The long and short is they can't predict the present accurately if you give them the data from the past.
Correct.
So you have first Earth Day in 1970. U.S. Davis Kenneth Watts said, if present trends continue, the world will be about 4 degrees colder in 1990 and 11 degrees colder by the year 2000.
Right.
This is about twice what it would take to put us in an ice age. I don't feel that cold.
I think everyone would agree that's a major,
well,
a major miss.
But it's a history of major misses.
Yes. The two things, Ken, that I'm not able to really get people to understand clearly is I think people are enormously resistant to facing up to how often their predictions are wrong in the past.
Yeah.
And it may have something to do with the need to acknowledge really how uncertain the future is.
Right.
But the other thing is, you know, if in fact this is not a genuine problem, either because it doesn't really exist or because technology in the form of hybrids and improved solar and blah, 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 over the course of the coming centuries, are just going to take it away.
Right.
Irrespective of any government action. If either of those things are true, and we go and spend a gazillion dollars on that instead of feeding hungry people, then we have done a terrible, terrible, terrible thing.
Yeah.
And no one that I see in the environmental movement will acknowledge that there is the possibility of making a tremendous, grave misallocation.
Yeah. Yeah.
It will kill millions and millions of people, and they just don't know.
It doesn't work, I know. And if you start doing a cost analysis sheet, basically, which is one of the things you've suggested for ideas in general, but if you do it for the environmental movement, going back to DDT, up to the present, with resource allocation, it's not a very pretty picture.
No, it's not. It's really not. And, you know, I mean, I think the short version of all that is that public health measures are tremendously effective, cost-effective.
Yeah.
The early environmental regulations and so on, which except for DDT, which were, by and large, were almost in the area of public health.
Yeah. Like
cleaning up the waterways and stuff.
Sure.
Were terrific.
Yeah.
The farther you go into regulating things that we can't see, regulating things that we're not sure what they do,
right,
the more that you get into situations where you can be spending literally tens or hundreds of millions of dollars per man year of life saved.
Yes.
It's a mistake.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah, well.
Well, and your book is kind of a bellwether for this in certain ways and kind of a barometer as well. And just to have it not addressed in the issues that we're talking about right now, for example, rather straightforwardly, you don't hear these kinds of conversations that often.
No.
And so what I would think of as a smear campaign anyway about you were, you know, a lackey of the oil companies and all of that, it coincides, like I say, in a strange double negative way with the fact that the Bush administration, now it would be tempting to say, well, they got the science right. But the fact of the matter is, even if the science was tending in the other direction, they would tend to not follow the science either. In other words, they politicize science just as much as the liberals do.
Absolutely.
It's just even a broken clock gives the right time twice a day. And so they just happen to be getting it right this time in certain ways, but for all the wrong reasons, but for enough to get you invited to the White House. Isn't that kind of funny?
I think actually that, you know, there's more people than we know. For example, the House of Lords just today sent Tony Blair a report saying, drop Kyoto, it's a waste of time and money.
Yeah.
You know, I think there are a lot of areas where people are saying, you know, what are we doing here?
Yeah, So in other words, some of those folks might be getting the science right in the sense that they just can't.
I mean, what I feel about the administration is that in this case they have the science right, but they have the politics wrong.
Yeah, well, that's what I meant by saying that they're mixing it.
No, but I'm saying from my point of view, they haven't really mounted a educational campaign.
I see.
They haven't really gone out and said, look, we don't agree with it, and this is why we don't.
Yep.
They haven't really made platforms for people in their administration to, they haven't, I think, whatever the criteria are for selecting people,
yep.
I don't feel that this is a eloquent administration.
Yeah. Well, here's the issue on that, and this is what one of the second topics I want to talk about, because you and I both still talk in a funny, weird way, which is that we think if we lay out the facts and the evidence in a coherent fashion, people will get it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Silly us.
Yeah.
And the fact of the matter is,
still believing it.
I know. It's an inherent, natural, naive mistake that we tend to do. But there are at least two reasons. There are many. But there are at least two reasons that people won't see facts, that even any community of the knowledgeable 30 years from now, looking back, would agree were facts that people simply would not see. And one of them is what you call state of fear, and I'll just call sociological factors in a sense. And another one that I talk about a lot is frankly just, you know, stages of development, that people see different things at different stages of development, and if you're not at a particular stage sufficient, then you're just not going to see it. And we tend not to notice that too much because everybody gets a pretty good education. We're all sort of in the same ballpark. But I've come down again and again and again to there are really nuances and facts and things like being systems theory and that kind of information. And it really does take a certain cognitive level to even see the data or a certain level of self-development to see the data. And if people aren't developed to that, they just don't tend to see the data. And, you know, that's a difficult issue, but I think it's a very important issue.
But, I think there's no question you're right. And I've had people just sort of say to me bluntly, you know, this issue's not going to ever be resolved on the evidence.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, creepy in a way. But,
yeah, it is.
You know, I think it is a reality. I mean, and, you know, you told me before the book was published, you said, you know, a certain percentage are going to get it immediately, a certain percentage are going to mull it over.
Yeah.
And this much larger percentage is just going to say no.
Yeah. And certain percentage is going to say no, and they did.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you pretty accurately called it.
Yeah. Well, the stage or level of development, and there's always higher levels for all of us, so it's not an elitist thing, or it's an elitism to which everybody's invited. But that's one factor. Another factor is really that psychological fear, the fear factor, state of fear, the fear itself doesn't match the reality. And so even if people say, well, but what if we could be wrong? We could be wrong, and so therefore we have to. And they keep themselves in a constant state of panic.
Yeah.
And if they are wrong, you know, you run worst-case scenarios. Okay, it goes a fourth a degree, and what's going to happen? Well, last time we made $15 trillion extra in agriculture because we had a longer growing season.
That's right. That was the last El Nino.
That's right, the El Nino, exactly. Yeah. People were saying, oh, look what's going to happen. I said, yeah, I know. This is great.
Yeah.
So, but they want to be afraid.
Yeah.
And so we're not in any way saying that don't be concerned about it. We're saying look at the science for it. But there is this state of fear, and in part it's a sociological state that's generated, in part it's a political state that's generated. You explore that. In part it's a state of psychological fear and a kind of an edgy knowingness about it. And that particular part I call boomeritis. Boomeritis is basically pluralism plus narcissism. And so pluralism says all views are equal, and narcissism says that's exactly right, all views are equal, and I'm right. And so pluralism gives a happy home for narcissism because it's sort of like it's a theoretical stance in academia. It's kind of a liberal-ish, not liberal, I don't want to identify with political party, but it's a liberal-ish stance in society. Nobody can challenge me. Everybody has a right to their own truth.
Right.
So under the tent of pluralism, narcissism makes a happy home. And it's a classic, in my opinion, pre-post-confusion. Post-conventional freedom is confused with pre-conventional egocentric license. Just anything I want to do is right. And that, strangely, has got hooked up with environmental concerns and all sorts of liberal concerns. And it's produced, really, both a state of both fear, on the one hand, and a state of meism, you know, that's just really bizarre. You know, I'm no prude or anything like that at all, but I'm getting shocked. I mean, it's just off the wall. Do you see the latest one? The woman is suing NASA for putting that rocket into that comet because it screwed up her astrological health?
Yeah, although I tend to think, Ken, this is a demonstration that we have too many attorneys. Because somebody had to file that, you know what I mean?
Listen, I agree with you, but there has to be a cultural climate that actually would let that get in the door.
Yeah.
And the door is
to say nothing of the cultural climate that will report it as news.
Well, exactly. Oh, I totally agree. Well, the lawyers have greased the skids of boomeritis. There's no question.
Yeah.
It's every ego now has its lawyer.
Yes.
It's just like 50,000
cars. You know, we have something like, you know, we used to have 50% of the world supply of lawyers. I think we now have 90%.
I hear anywhere from 70 to 90.
Yeah, I don't know that we really need that many attorneys.
I can't tell which cause is which, because in a nation of egos, you better have a lawyer. You know, I think it's both, and clearly both. But it's like, my goodness, you can't go anywhere now without really having to watch every single thing you do.
Yeah. But see, I think part of that is, for example, the medical profession had a very influential study, I think, from the 60s, in which they found that they looked at neurosurgeons, and they found that the amount of neurosurgery performed in a community was a function of the number of neurosurgeons.
Yeah.
And they then very quietly began to discourage certain specialties, you know, beyond the numbers that were really perceived to be. I mean, you don't need very many neurosurgeons in any place. And I think if we were to raise the bar, so to speak, in terms of attorneys, this highly intelligent group might go do something more useful.
But here's the problem. The only people in charge of doing that are the lawyers.
Yes.
Exactly. Seriously, this deeply worries me. They started to think about it when I noticed that Bill Clinton had his diversity cabinet, you know, 18 people more or less that were this and this and more were this and more were that. They were all lawyers.
Yes.
And I thought about it. I thought, oh, there's something is deeply sick here, and it's just unbelievable. And I don't know how to get out of it because the only people that could get you out of it is a lawyer.
Yes.
So I'm going to hire a lawyer and take a class action lawsuit out against lawyers.
That's a nice idea.
Actually, that might work.
Yeah. All right, I like that.
Oh, my God. Well, has anybody picked up the movie rights?
No.
See, that to me is, and we talked about this, we said it almost certainly, this would be the first novel you have ever written that doesn't become a film. Now, probably eventually it will, because it's just too gripping. And I told you, I think it's one of the best things you've done in really years. I love all of your stuff, but there's just some aliveness to this, I think possibly because, you know, we're both so concerned that there's a kind of emotional charge that helps drive a certain kind of edgy clarity of writing. Really, you think that's true?
I'll take your word for it. No, I do think it's true, actually. There's no question that if you have strong feelings, you...
Got it.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, I'm very proud of having done that because,
I am too.
You know, I, like everybody, crave approval. And, you know, to go out and disagree with what most of the world says is true is a big step for me personally.
Exactly. And I was, you know, when I read it, I read some of the early drafts, I really was worried about really some fanatics actually targeting you.
Mm-hmm.
It's become so politicized that at the extreme end, you're such an influential voice, and I think this is so, I think it's so compellingly drawn that I was really concerned. And so it must have been a step for you to do it, and I think it's fantastic. I really do. I think it's fantastic that you stepped into that.
Well, I'm pleased that, you know, I think the effect of having done that is not because, of course, you don't get into debates. Academics wouldn't debate a novelist. But what it does is it opens the door for people to start to talk. So, you know, I noticed that Stuart Brand had a, you know, who's certainly an early environmentalist, did the whole art catalog. You know, he has a thing where he says, yes, population is going to go down. The population bomb is not going on.
Yeah, he did. He did.
And Robert Samuelson in the Washington Post said, yeah, Kyoto's getting to be a bunch of lying politicians.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's starting a little bit that people are, I think, are able to begin to express things that they might have hesitated to before because...
Yeah. Well, I have to tell you, too, about one of the things I admire about your writing, and I've mentioned this before because I still don't quite see how you do it, and it's this, and it's a very interesting thing. Some novelists, you read some various types of writers even, and sometimes you find different levels of the artistic presentation that you can particularly admire. In some, you can admire sentence structure. I've actually looked at sentences and gone, that's such a beautiful sentence. And then you thought, of course, great poet steal. Okay, I'm going to use that kind of sentence the next time I do. And then others, it can kind of go up there. Sometimes you really enjoy a novel, but you can't really figure out why.
Mm-hmm.
Not particularly anything you'd walk away from or anything like that, or steal. And one of the things that I find so compelling about your work is images pop into my mind as I read. Intense, vivid images. I can see where you are. It's just really interesting because I try to break it down and look at sentences. And sometimes the sentences are really deceptively very simple, elegant sentences. What we say, just plain English. But they come together in a way that I was looking for at this time. I was watching my own mind as I read the draft that you sent of State of Fear. So I thought, I'm going to figure it out this time. So I was watching really close. And I was watching really close. Okay, next sentence. No, next sentence. Pow! Up comes the scene. And it's like, and you probably have, you know, no idea how you do this because you don't consciously sit there and do it. But you somehow convey sentences in a way that all of a sudden these really vivid textures and scenes and locales just come right up into view, almost like a hologram in your mind. And then you've done this from the beginning, which I'm guessing why it so naturally converts to something like film. But it's really quite astonishing. And I think that's why, you know, you're such a just a really premier storyteller in that sense.
Well, thanks.
Yeah.
I think it's just a description of my process because that's what happens in my head.
Mm-hmm.
I see pictures, so I describe the pictures.
Yeah.
To the extent that I have any idea about how it works, I think it's very dependent on the specific order in which the information is presented.
Yeah. Well, that's good. I'm sorry. That's exactly what the many faces of terrorism. But go ahead and finish that because I want to tell you why it
saves. Well, I notice it in other people's work. In Coppola's first Godfather, there's this scene where Michael Corleone is explaining to his fiancée about the guys who work with his father, and there's this extended thing where he begins with what sounds like a discussion of a contract and ends with a threat of murder. And it's maybe 7 or 8 sentences, but the exact way that it's laid out and exactly how he goes from point A to point B is really beautifully done.
Wow, yeah.
Worth looking at for just to see how he did it.
Yeah. Well, order of presentation is true even when you're disordering it, in other words. There's a way to do that that's still, you have to do it in a certain way that is almost faithful, I also want to say, to the rules of the brain or something.
I agree.
Or else it jars so badly. And I'm sure that those rules include hidden syntactical rules, and I bet they're even like narrative archetypes. There are all sorts of things. And if you violate those, you're in trouble. Because then it's fingernails on the blackboard, and you can't really convey content if you don't get the syntax right, so to speak.
And there's other things, too, that are very mysterious to me. For example, repetitiveness is very destructive.
How?
Well, I think there's a great tendency for writers to, especially if they're working from notes that they've made, to sort of say the same thing twice.
Yep.
Or either one right after another in the same page,
or
to say
a good point.
20 or 50 pages later.
That's good.
And I don't know why it is, but it greatly diminishes the impact. Because you're reading along and go, no, I heard that already.
Yeah.
And the reader, for some reason, at least in my experience, heavily penalizes that.
Yeah.
And often writers are kidding themselves, saying, well, you know I said something like this, but this is a little bit different.
Yeah.
And I think that the people who ruthlessly cut those redundancies out, you know, get a lot more life in their in what they're doing.
I heard a phrase once from an editor that's very close to this, cut out your darlings.
Yes. That was actually, I think, Colette, wasn't it?
Was it?
To Hemingway.
Oh, wow. Well, John Brockman told me it. I
know
it, dude. Very briefly now, because I do want to get your hit on this. Well, I'm trapped in a bad Michael Crichton novel, and I don't know how to get out.
Well, how'd we get in?
I have no idea.
Then follows an hour and a half of Michael Crichton helping Ken Wilber fix his bad Michael Crichton novel.
So now I'm back. I'm still looking at this thing going, okay, all right, I've got a bad Michael Crichton novel in three parts. And can this all be shaken down and shook out and shrunk and all that kind of stuff in any way that is interesting to anybody at all?
Well, whip it over.
This is great, buddy. I thank you a ton. And it'd be probably about, like I said, maybe 3 weeks.
Okay.
Can I get that to you?
Sure.
Thanks, pal.
Nice to talk to you, Ken.
It's great talking to you, buddy.
See you later.
Let's do it again.
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
It'd be great. Bye.
Bye.
You are listening to www.integralnaked.org.